I understand Bob Goldstein actually wrote a song as a tribute to Charleston.
After being there for a while, the 4 weeks, it was also a military town, so a lot of military people came in, and it was extremely historical and haunting, the whole atmosphere of Charleston, South Carolina, that he decided to write a song called Charleston, and it was haunting and historical, beautiful, beautiful song. And he was able to announce it on the radio station there that the song would be performed, for the town. And we got a super big audience for that, and people were, had tears and joy and everything when they heard the song. And Bob Goldstein also, with our comedy skits, had a light show. He performed a light show for our show also, so it was fun. We were like a little baby growing up, with our whole act there, but people grew to like us as we were growing. They liked watching us becoming better and better.
Did your audience increase in size over the 4 weeks at 300 King Street?
Oh, it was standing room only. Right. People were baking us cakes and everything. Yeah, they liked our group a lot, and especially the boys. There was because we had the guys had the English look, there were four guys with black hair and boots, and the girls were, they learned to, when they saw them in town, scream and run after them. And Sherry and I had our pictures, just like actually on the album covers, painted on fire hydrants, and it was really quite exciting.
So as you wind up your job at 300 King Street in Charleston, your single comes out from the second album, and that's Castle on the Corner. Did that have any airplay around the country?
It probably did, but I don't have any record of it. I would have had to heard from the sources. It's not like we have the internet today. You can just get online and see what's going on. I did not hear. I would think that it got airplay, but it said it was a hit radio song in the Philadelphia area, so I'm sure it had other airplay around the country.
Now, I understand that Jezebel was retired, and you adopted a new mascot of sorts. What's the story?
We decided to retire her because her getting off an airplane in, I think it was Miami or Cocoa Beach, her feet fell off, and they had to be re-glued on, and then we all had viruses, got sick, the whole group. We had to cancel a booking. We decided to retire her, and we were looking for a new mascot, and this time we got a five-week-old female Kinkajou bear. It's a honey bear. It's a nocturnal fruit-eating mammal native to the rainforests of Central and South America.
And that kind of looks like a monkey, right?
Yes, it does.
And you traveled around now with this new mascot, and what was the name?
We called the little bear Boogie Woogie, but the trivia on that is we're in Charleston, South Carolina, and we're introducing our new mascot, Boogie Woogie, and that is not a good terminology for Southern people. It had a racial connotation that maybe was not the nicest.
So based on your success at 300 King Street, you had additional jobs there after the first initial 4 weeks.
Right. Our resting place in between New York City and Minnesota, and actually wound up being Charleston, was Kurt's parents' house in McLean, Virginia. We had a couple little bookings after Charleston, and then once again in November 1964, we were booked again at 300 King Street for 5 days. What had happened is they had a comedian booked there, and he was not happy with the club, and I guess they weren't happy with him. Anyway, he just left town after performing one night.
Now, I understand that the male members of the band were getting a lot of attention by female fans there.
Yes, it was. It actually got to the point where you felt like you were going to be mobbed. We were staying at one hotel, and we were kicked out because of female fans. We had to move into a motel while we were performing in Charleston, South Carolina.
So once again in early December 64, you're back at the Epic Columbia Studios in New York City to work on your third album.
Right. So now we had we were amplified guitar, and we had the electric bass, and we had Murray with his lead guitar, harmonica, and Ron Edgar at the drums. So we were definitely becoming more and more innovative. So with that went some new innovative songs, and one of them was called Nothing Wrong With You. That was written by Beverly Ross and Bob Goldstein, and it sounded like it could have been a Beatle hit, it with our harmonies and all. It was a great song. We loved it. We were booked in Canada once again, and it was canceled. So, of course, Charleston, whenever there was an opening, and we had an opening, they would welcome us back with open arms. So around the Christmas holiday, we were back at 300 King Street, and we printed up some Christmas cards, had a wonderful holiday. For being on the road so much, we were actually able to stay at Who Became a Friend, Luther's home, and a maid was hired for us to cook and clean, and we could actually, you know, get a little bit more rest, work on the act, and have a nice Christmas holiday. It was great.
And you played on the New Year's Eve of that year, too, right?
Right. It went right into New Year's Eve. Kurt turned 21 on January 7th, right after New Year's Eve, and they had a surprise party for him. Then we got our tape for the third album coming out. It was June Bride Baby, written by Beverly Ross and Bob Goldstein. I'm Gonna Marry You, written by Bob Goldstein. Nothing More to Look Forward To. These are by other people. Freight Train, Line and Track, Last People on Earth, Hush Hush, There's Nothing Wrong With You That My Love Can't Cure. It was the same one as There's Nothing Wrong With You, but they extended it to That My Love Can't Cure. Licorice, written by Bob Goldstein and Beverly Ross. Hopefully, they are hoping it would be like a next hit after Lollipop. Walking Down the Line, Tell It to the Wind, was co-written by Jeff Barry, and he had a lot of hit songs. I can hear one of them in my head, but I can't. If anybody looked up Jeff Barry, they could find out that he had some really big hits out there.
Well, Jeff Barry was co-writer on Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups, as well as Be My Baby by the Ronettes.
Right, so you know who Jeff Barry was. As I come away from everything, you know, as time went on, I would have to say my favorite song today of all the Goldbriar recordings, although I loved them all, was Tell It to the Wind. That is so eerie, it just gives me goosebumps.
So you had 11 songs finished, but you had additional songs that were in the can already completed to pick as a 12th song, is that right?
Right. I don't know what 12th song, which 12th song they picked. There was the extra ones in the can were My Song, Que Bonita, Sunshine Special, We Shall Overcome, Noah, and Sarah Jane.
And that's the same Sarah Jane that you performed on the Hootenanny Show down in Tennessee.
Right, but it's the Sarah Jane with the full arrangement, not the, you know, the short version they gave us.
Now, Keith Olsen is with you on this trip. He also decides to do some promotion work for the Goldbriars in California.
Right. He had played bass for Jimmy Rogers. He had played bass for Gail Garnett. And, you know, he had been out there on the road and met a lot of people, and he liked the Goldbriar sound. So he took a copy of the tape of our third album, and he decided to promote our group in California. And the Wayfarers were playing in California at this time, and he also was going to have them promote the Goldbriars.
And at some point here, it looks like mid-February 1965, Sean Bonniwell decides to join you on a trip you have booked out in Denver.
By this time, he was back from California. The Wayfarers had broken up, and he wanted, he offered to be our manager, which we needed a manager at the time, a road manager, and he also wanted a ride back to California. So it was, a tit for tat. And he wanted to pursue his own musical career aside from the Wayfarers. So we were all traveling together all of a sudden, all six of us, plus Sean Bonniewell and the Bear, and we had to add another seat to our wagon, our woody wagon. So, and that was facing backwards, so we actually had three seats in the car. It was real cramped.
And you picked up another animal in Texas.
Right, in Texas, there was a stray dog at a FINA gas station. And so we just picked the dog up. We felt sorry for it. We could tell it was homeless. And we named the dog FINA. So now we had two animals in the car with seven people.
Now, when was your job at the Exodus in Denver?
We got booked in at the Exodus on February 1965. We were the first Amplified group to play at, this was called a folk club, but now we are Amplified. This was on the way to California. We were hoping to make our way to California at that point, but we already had the booking in Denver, and Sean took care of the financial agreement with the club and also assisting in promoting our group performing there. And he also took the first photo of our new group lineup. It's the one with the large stepladder as a prop, and all six of us, three at the base and three going up the ladder, and he calls it Fast Climbing Stars.
So as you're playing in Denver now, something happens, and with Bob Stein, who's the owner of a popular nightclub in Pasadena, California, called the Ice House.
He might have heard about us through Keith Olson. I remember they were out in California promoting, and also the Wayfarers at that time, a little ways back. So he is the owner of the Ice House in Pasadena. Because he heard about us, he flew out to the Exodus to hear our group perform, and he hired us for a three-week job in Pasadena. So he, Bob returned to California, and we went from Denver to the Ice House in Pasadena.
And that would have started when?
It was March 2nd of 1965.
What do you recall about the Ice House?
It just looked like it could have been a warehouse before. It was like rectangular, and there was a stage on the end, and then it was just going on and on and on with seats, and then on the other end was like, there was like a bar. It was separated by a wall, and then there were booths.
And again, like the Exodus in Denver, this is a folk club.
Yeah, this is definitely a folk club, but here we were Amplified, so we were, you know, something new. We were, I'm sure, the first Amplified group that performed there with our sound, with a folk pop rock sound, when they were a folk club, so it wasn't a rock and roll club.
Do you recall the first night you played there?
I'm sure we were tired from traveling. Our traveling really does take a toll on you, especially when we had such cramped quarters. Our first night, Tom, the bass player, got ill and just walked right off stage. You know, so we had to work with five members for the first night. We still did well, but it certainly would have helped to have the bass sound, that underneath current that really makes a song sound fuller.
I understand you ran into a folk rock band out there. What do you recall about that?
We had a very good reception, and that back room with the bar and the booths and stuff where you'd go sit, you could sit in between and your sets and rest. Kurt was back there, and I remember being back there a few times. There were two, three guys, and I remember them saying they were from the group called the 13 Men. They would come constantly and brainstorm with Kurt. They were extremely interested in our sound, and since Kurt was the leader, they were there to talk to him. And who would have guessed it, but you know, down the road Kurt became their producer for their first two albums, and they became The Association. And he also did their vocal arrangements. That, besides a producer, he was really, the vocal arrangements were Kurt's for such hits as Along Comes Mary and Cherish.
Right, and those were on their first album, which was released the following year, 1966, and Kurt also produced their second album.
Right, he worked on both of their albums, and you can hear him singing on the end of Long Comes Mary, and you can hear him singing on the end of Cherish, where the real high part travels around. I mean, if you know his voice, you say, oh, there's Kurt. You know, you could hear him.
So after the job at the Ice House in Pasadena, you move over to Orange County at the Mecca.
John Denver had just finished performing there, and Gail Garnett was the last week of her booking there. We shared the stage with her, and then I believe we were there for another week or so by ourselves. And I remember Keith Olsen was playing the bass for her.
And you happened to be staying with your group at the same motel as Gail Garnett and her backup group.
Yes, it was, I remember it was like a couple stories high. It wasn't really big, but, you know, it was like typical motel rooms, but, you know, between people running back and forth, it was pretty busy.
And did you play on any TV shows in Los Angeles?
While we were there, we were invited to perform on the Sam Riddle Show. So the Goldbriars performed. And you know something? I think it was June Bride Baby that we performed. I'm not positive.
What about the other shows that were out there, such as Hullabaloo and Shindig?
We were just automatically went to the Sam Riddle Show. We sang. Actually, we pantomimed, lip synced to our own recording. But we had to audition for Hullabaloo and Shindig. We were accepted on both of them, and Jack Good, the show's producer of Hullabaloo, said it was the best live audition he ever had. He made you audition live. You couldn't lip sync. So, but he said we were the best live audition he ever had, and I was wondering, what did the rest of them sound like live? We had no idea. You know, it's amazing what recordings can do, more so today than in the old days, but...
Now, I understand while you were playing at the Mecca in Buena Park that Epic put out a 45 from the third album called June Bride Baby, backed with I'm Gonna Marry You.
Right.
And those songs are really more pop than folk. Would that be correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And they got very good reviews, positive reviews in Billboard, Cashbox, and Variety.
And I understand the manager for Gail Garnett liked the Goldbriars as well.
We met him because of Gail Garnett, and he became our business manager.
What was his name?
David Marish.
And did he book any jobs for you?
Right. He booked us a one-night booking at the Coconut Grove in L.A. That was super big time. It was a nightclub, and it had been a former Grand Ballroom in the Ambassador Hotel in a great entertainment venue for many years, by celebrities and show business people.
It was a hot spot for the people in Hollywood to show up there.
Right, and Sherry and I, we wore hair pieces on top of our head, like a little bun, besides our hair down. And Kurt's mom embroidered gold two-piece dresses for us, and the guys rented tuxedos. I mean, you had to fit in with the scenery. This place was really very exquisite.